used when addressing various public forums. Please put your cell phones on silent mode. Thank you. Good morning. So, poverty, progress in poverty, a puzzle, the economy. You must be a bunch of hardy souls to come out of a Sunday morning indeed to consider the likes of that. And that reminds me of a joke. A soldier, an engineer, and an economist are stranded on a desert island. A couple of weeks go by, they're starving, and then they discover a can of beans. The soldier takes the first crack at them and tries to open them with a rock. But it seems that the rocks on the island are a little too soft, and that doesn't work. The engineer gives it a shot next. Takes the can, goes up to a high cliff, and drops it off, figuring soft or not, the gravity will do the work, but no luck there. So the economist sizes up the situation, and he looks at the other guys and he says, first, we must assume we have a can opener. So, hardy souls you are indeed, if you thought that we were talking about economics. Actually, though, as Sam Gamgee of The Lord of the Rings might put it, we will and we won't, if you take my meaning. And actually, the important and the final, I'm sorry to say, joke of this talk, and the one that'll be on the test, is this one. These two guys, not very bright guys, I'll tell no ethnic jokes this morning, so supply your own nationality. These two dumb guys are out in the woods deer hunting, and they shoot a buck. They're dragging it by the hind legs back to the car, and they pass this guy who happens to be there, and he sees these guys struggling, and he says, you know, that'll go a lot easier if you drag it by the antlers. So they start dragging it by the antlers, and they're going maybe 20, 30 minutes, and one of them says to the other, you know, that guy was right. It is a lot easier this way. And the other one says, yeah, I know. There's only one thing that bothers me. Now we're getting farther from the car. Okay, so now why do I mention this? Why do I mention this, ladies and gentlemen? I mention it because when it comes to our ability, using the conventional wisdom, to solve the puzzle of why or how poverty persists and even deepens as civilization progresses, we are moving farther from the car. At the moment, this wet Sunday morning in late September, it scarcely needs me telling you that we have a global economic crisis. Banks are failing, huge accounting firms and other well-established business concerns, rocks of stability we'd have thought would last forever, going under, mass layoffs ongoing. The question of the day is, given that the bills don't stop coming, if the income checks stop coming, what are you going to do? And for those who have been lucky enough to buck this trend, good luck bucking the anxiety of being caught up in it down the road. And in light of the wealth-producing power our modern civilization enjoys in the information age, it is puzzling that poverty persists and deepens. We can find all manner of useful information on a personal computer in a matter of seconds. We can design and manufacture with greater ease than ever before. Our transportation and our transportation infrastructure is more streamlined than ever. But across the board, on the whole, for people in general, it has long been the case, even before the current crisis, that you have to run harder and harder, financially speaking, just to keep from losing ground. 140 years ago, the very puzzle of which I speak was described this way. The present century has been marked by a prodigious increase in wealth-producing power, the utilization of steam and electricity, the introduction of improved processes and labor-saving machinery, the greater subdivision and grander scale of production, the wonderful facilitation of exchanges have multiplied enormously the effectiveness of labor. At the beginning of this marvelous era, it was natural to expect, and it was expected, that labor-saving inventions would lighten the toil and improve the condition of the laborer, that the enormous increase in the power of producing wealth would make real poverty a thing of the past. Now, however, we are coming into collision with facts which there can be no mistaking. From all parts of the civilized world come complaints of industrial depression, of labor condemned to involuntary idleness, of capital massed and wasting, of pecuniary distress among businessmen, of want and suffering and anxiety among the working classes. All the dull, deadening pain, all the keen, maddening anguish that to great masses of men are involved in the words hard times afflict the world today. Just as a community realizes the conditions for which all civilized communities are striving and advances in the scale of material progress, just as closer settlement and a more intimate connection with the rest of the world and greater utilization of labor-saving machinery make possible greater economies in production and exchange, and wealth in consequence increases not merely in the aggregate but in proportion to population, so does poverty take a darker aspect. Some get an infinitely better and easier living, but others find it hard to get a living at all. The tramp comes with the locomotive, and almshouses and prisons are as surely the marks of material progress as are costly dwellings, rich warehouses, and magnificent churches. Upon streets lighted with gas and patrolled by uniformed policemen, beggars wait for the passerby, and in the shadow of college and library and museum are gathering the more hideous Huns and fiercer Vandals of whom Macaulay prophesied. So wrote Henry George in the book entitled, coincidentally enough, Progress and Poverty. So what can we do, what can we, and what do we expect from conventional thought on either the left or the right to solve the riddle? As to what can be expected from the left, I put it to you that the failure of the grand Soviet experiment, totalitarianism, anyone, unlivable society, or the inadequacy of federal funding, that is, collective funding, to have prevented or to reassuringly even address the current collapse should suggest that from that quarter there may not be an effective answer. And the worldview from the left seems to me the best, that is, most compassionate, that is now available in conventional thinking on social problems. On the right, well, we need only reflect on the legacies of the Bush administration. How do you like the environment now, gentlemen? Global economic collapse, anyone? Perhaps that's unfair to conservatives. Perhaps the seeds of the current economic climate were planted back in the Clinton era. But even so, we have long had what is proclaimed to be the strongest example of so-called free market enterprise or so-called capitalism, and look how we are doing with it. And as for up-to-the-minute official commentary, in the last week or so, our leading experts have told us only these two things about the current global crisis. One, the economy has at last bottomed out, but two, the layoffs will continue. As I said then, with respect to the global economy, we are getting farther from the car. That being the case, this year, as we enter that season when I have taken to addressing people, hardy souls like yourselves, and ethical culture, I say to myself, what better topic than the life and thought of the man whose writing I have just quoted? Henry George's personal history is the story of the transformative impact of an insight on a life, and at the heart of the transformation, a puzzle and a solution. Before the insight, George was a venturesome Philadelphian who tried his hand first at merchant seamanship, then at prospecting out west, then as a printer's apprentice, and had finally settled into a career as a California-based journalist, an editorial writer, and an editor. It's true that he had been gaining a certain amount of attention from his writing about social problems, but it was a revelation of sorts that served as a kind of turning point in his life. In 1869, on behalf of the small newspaper he wrote for and edited, he'd gone to New York City to try to secure decent newswire service from the big telegraph companies. The trip was a failure on that score. The bigger papers and the telegraph companies had a relationship that papers of his type could not break in on. But the trip was valuable to him in another way. As his biographer George Geiger put it, it was in New York that George saw at first hand an example of the bewildering coincidence of progress and poverty that he had been vaguely conscious of. Here in that mighty city of the East, where wealth and prestige were written on every brownstone front and the very air seemed charged with power, misery and wretchedness were already smugly accepted and the slums were beginning to fester. And in New York, George vowed to himself to solve the puzzle. The solution to the puzzle, or at least the seminal insight which would make a committed reformer out of him, would come to him later back in California. But let's hold off on that insight for just a moment to fast forward to the facts of his life after that revelatory moment. Working out over the next 9 years a body of thought based on the seminal insight, he produced what remains his best-known work, Progress in Poverty. It sold in the millions of copies, more than many a bestseller of its day, and this in the days before mass advertising. It was translated into French, Spanish, German, Dutch, Hungarian, Swedish, Russian, and Chinese. Speaking and writing further about the ideas set down in that book, George amassed and inspired many followers, among them a good number of prominent figures. Tolstoy, Sun Yat-sen, who's a rare example of a statesman revered both in the People's Republic of China and Taiwan, the young Winston Churchill, the young Clarence Darrow, who began his public speaking career at a rally for George, the young George Bernard Shaw. George went on to debate some of the leading figures of his time, Pope Leo XIII, the Scottish Duke of Argyll, himself a prominent writer of that day, and as debate was declined in this instance, he criticized in a provocative book entitled The Perplexed Philosopher, the social thinking of the philosopher Herbert Spencer. His followers nominated him to run twice for mayor of New York. When he died in the middle of his second mayoral campaign, 100,000 people turned out to mourn him. He was eulogized by, among others, Felix Adler, the founder of ethical culture. And now let's return to that moment of insight. The time is the late summer of 1870, not that long after the end of the Civil War. The country is still in the throes of what would come to be known as the Panic and Depression of 1869. The Transcontinental Railroad has just been completed. The place is the hills just outside San Francisco, which is to say the site more or less of the closing of the frontier. And with that closing and the joining of coasts by the railroad, land values in the San Francisco area have skyrocketed. George has gone out riding and remembers the revelatory moment thus. Absorbed in my own thoughts, I had driven the horse into the hills until he panted. Stopping for breath, I asked a passing teamster, for want of something better to say, what land was worth there. He pointed to some cows grazing off so far that they looked like mice and said, "I don't know exactly, but there is a man over there who will sell some land for $1,000 an acre," which in those days was a huge sum. Like a flash, it came upon me that there was the reason of advancing poverty with advancing wealth. With the growth of population, land grows in value, and the men who work it must pay more for the privilege. I turned back amidst quiet thought to the perception that then came to me and has been with me ever since. What comes in that moment to George then is this. The growing prosperity of the San Francisco area has mostly benefited not the people of that area on the whole, but the owners of land there, and particularly the owners of large and/or particularly valuable tracts of land in the form of increased land values and the rise of rent. It is based on this insight that he works out in his head and in a number of writings that it is the institution of private property in land that is responsible for the increase of want with the increase of wealth. Similarly, he concludes that it is only the products of labor, directly or indirectly, that is, wages or interest, that are or ought by right to be subject to private ownership, while land cannot justly be privately owned. The constituent ideas which together make up George's thinking on social problems differ markedly in important respects from the tenets of the conventional wisdom both left and right. I can do no more in a talk of this length than describe them fairly briefly, but I will do at least that. George clarifies that the three factors of wealth production, three elements as necessary to the creation of wealth as heat, oxygen, and fuel are for the creation of fire, are land, labor, and capital. By itself, this does not seem particularly revolutionary, nor do his definitions of terms. He defines wealth quite sensibly as natural products so secured, moved, combined, or altered by human labor as to fit them for the satisfaction of human desires. And he defines capital as wealth that is used not directly to satisfy human desire by consumption, but for the purpose of obtaining more wealth. Think of a person who finds a fruit tree and expends labor picking the fruit. The result of that labor, the picked apples, could then be applied directly to the satisfying of desire by being eaten, or the picked fruits can be held for sale or exchange. In the first instance, there is wealth consumed, in the second, wealth held for use as capital. From these definitions, it is clear enough that wealth can only be produced by the operation of labor, human exertion, on land, the natural universe. But this analysis of wealth production differs in two respects, at least, from other analyses, both those predating and those surviving George. First, George is clear and consistent in defining wealth, where other thinkers in the field, those preceding him and those coming after, are inconsistent, sometimes adopting the meaning just mentioned, sometimes confusing the term with the term value, and after all, land too has value, and virtually always giving it a meaning that is vaguer or shifting or both. Second, and similarly, George draws a clear distinction between land and capital where others do not. John Stuart Mill, who had been one of George's mentors for a while, and virtually all others who have considered the subject, essentially confuse and mingle the two terms. And it is the ramifications of those fairly simple differences in thinking that are tremendous. For one thing, if land is distinguished from capital or from any other wealth produced by human exertion, and if it is understood that labor, whether by itself or with the use of capital, must act upon land to produce wealth, the wages fund theory, which persists in popular economic thought, is shown to be a fallacy. And that, in turn, has huge significance where thought on social problems is concerned. According to the wages fund theory, the ultimate source of wages paid to the laborer is the fund of capital devoted to and set aside for that purpose. That being the case, so the theory would have it, the more laborers, the smaller the wages available on the average to each laborer. Under this view, in other words, capital being likened to the pie that feeds all, the more mouths, the less pie for each mouth. This, incidentally, is the strongest source of anti-immigrant sentiment, something I'm well aware of from my day job as an immigration lawyer, which you've heard about before. And many of my fellow immigration lawyers are ideologically torn by their dedication to the cause of immigration and their belief in the validity of the wages fund theory. George shows that the wages fund theory must be erroneous. He points out that the ultimate source of wages is not capital, but the labor that produces wealth, that the operation of the production and distribution of wealth depends not primarily upon the preexistence of a fund of capital unrelated to labor, but far more fundamentally upon the exertion of labor itself. Business, whether simple or complex, is fundamentally hand-to-mouth, and the flow of wages back to the laborer is siphon-like, ultimately depending on the wealth produced by labor. Or, in pie-eating terms, what the theory mistakenly leaves out of the account is that with each new mouth that comes into the world, there is also a pair of hands, hands capable of labor and thus wealth production that come with it. George also points out that if labor and capital are naturally opposed to each other, as the theory mandates, wages would be expected to be high where interest, that is the return to capital, is low, and vice versa, whereas the truth is that wages and interest rise and fall with each other and not in inverse proportion. According to the wages fund theory, labor and capital, or laborers and capitalists, so-called, are natural antagonists, what is good for one being bad for the other. This bears repeating, because it is essentially the thinking that is central to Marxism. But George, developing and improving upon the thought of earlier thinkers, for example, the French physiocrats of the 18th century, such as Turgot or François Quesnay, makes it clear that where land is subject to private ownership, it is in effect land, or more properly speaking, the holders of large tracts of land, rather than capital or capitalists, that are the natural antagonists of labor, and in fact, of labor and capital both. Again, this is made clear from the central idea that labor must have access to land in order for wealth to be produced. Another and similar consequence of George's thinking is that it debunks the Malthusian theory. According to that theory, ascribed to David Malthus, an Englishman of the 18th century, increase of population brings about the conditions of poverty because increase of population has a natural tendency to outstrip the ability of nature to produce the wealth that is needed to support population. But George points out that, in fact, population tends to increase the efficiency of wealth production. His thinking also makes clear that there is another and entirely man-made, as opposed to natural, dynamic that depresses wages and makes poverty persist and deepen as civilization progresses. And once again, that is private property and land, both in and of itself as a wrongful monopoly and insofar as it must bring with it land speculation. A word or two about land speculation, because it plays an important role in George's understanding of social problems. The value of land increasing as a community develops and progresses, where land may be privately held, it is tempting, even inevitable, that some, many, and some on a grand scale, will hold it strictly for speculative purposes, against some future day when it can be expected to be worth more than they bought it for. And that dynamic will tend to hold land out of use, that is, will tend to keep it out of the access of labor. The more that process goes on, the farther people will have to travel from any given center of population to get access to land, and the more land will be worth, being needed as much as ever, but harder to get access to. Two very local examples may be useful here, or if not useful, maybe interesting. In 1991 or so, correct me if I'm wrong on any of these figures, my wife and I bought a house on Ridgewood Road in Millburn for $175,000. 5 years later, after putting about $20,000 of expenditure into it, we sold it for around $300,000, $350,000, something like that. The market value of houses in Millburn, as in so many towns and cities throughout the country, had climbed steadily, and in Millburn in particular, in those years, it had climbed precipitously. Now, we did not buy the property in order to turn it around at a profit, and we might like to think, and at least one of us does think, that it was our cleverness in choice of interior paint color, or rather basic tan, affordable, new wall-to-wall carpeting, that netted us this handsome return. But in any event, the truth was that it was the market for land in Millburn and the introduction of New Jersey Transit Midtown Direct service, which brought resident commuters within one rather pleasant 40-minute train ride of Midtown Manhattan, that put the windfall into our pockets, and had we sought to time it better and been able to do so, I think 2 or 3 years between purchase and sale of that property probably would have netted us the greater part of that gain. Considering the money we made from one deal to the next, we had expended little to no labor of our own. I know my wife would disagree with me here, but I did virtually all of the painting that wasn't done by an outside guy, and besides, I'm giving the talk here, so who are you going to believe? Rather, it was the growth of value due to the growing desirability of living in Millburn, the progress of the community, the development of the community infrastructure that increased market value. We did not engage in these transactions in order to speculate in land. We needed to cut down on our carrying costs, and when a broker told us what we could get for that house, we jumped at the opportunity. But it was the easiest $100,000 we ever made, and it's a sore temptation to do the same thing over and over again. Financially speaking, it beats the hell out of the practice of immigration law, so far anyway. Now, consider a second local phenomenon. About 3 miles from here, down Millburn Avenue, past Millburn High School, and before you get to Morris Turnpike, on a large lot stands the old Saks Fifth Avenue building. You have probably passed it many times, even if you don't go there that frequently, because the large vacant building and the vast vacant parking lot on which it is situated have been a standing there vacant for at least 15 years, if not more. Recently, aware that this property had always intrigued me, if only on George's grounds, and knowing that the date for this talk was coming up, I took it upon myself to do a little research. Really, it was a little research. I simply Googled about the property, a search phrase of Saks Fifth Avenue building, Millburn, New Jersey, or the like, turned up some links, those links led to others, and pretty soon this picture emerged. It seems that the property has for the past 15 years been owned by a company called the Ahold Corporation. Ahold, A-H-O-L-D. Okay, I mean, okay. I'm not making it up. Which is a European conglomerate that owns, I assume, among other things, supermarket chains. And for at least some of that time, if not all of it, development of the property has been tied up in a kind of three or four cornered wrangling between Ahold, the townships of Milburn and Springfield, the property being on the border between them, and somewhat but not entirely sotto voce, King's Supermarket in Milburn. It seems that Ahold has been desirous of putting up a supermarket on the property. The people of Milburn and Springfield, or perhaps it's the developer types who like to go to town board meetings, whatever, are against that use of the property. King's is against that use of the property. And so nothing has been done. But I say to you, 15 years? Every so often, someone, a town resident, will look at the vacant property and propose to the town or to anyone who will listen, why don't we at the very least use the place for parking? Let's do something with it. There's a parking shortage in town. And they might well also add, space is tight in Milburn and goes at a premium, whether for residential or commercial purposes. A lot that size, that centrally located, represents a lot of use, a lot of access to land, if you will, and the holding of it out of use inevitably forces would-be users of that land, whether shoppers or residents or office space users, that much further out. At the same time, and for that very reason, it keeps the cost of the use of land in Milburn already high, that much higher than it would otherwise be. But as I well know, and as a real estate lawyer in the offices I share reminded me recently when I discussed this with her, there's nothing the town can do to force Ahold to sell the property. That's the law. Ahold owns it. A few years of wrangling, I could understand. That happens. A small space, who cares? But that much space and 15 years, there's no excuse for it. An explanation, in my view, my guess is that at this point this can only be land speculation, an explanation, a guess at best, but no excuse. In any event, you do not have to know the first thing about political economy to know that there is a serious sin against the public interest being committed here in keeping that much property in that location that long out of use. Ahold and the old Saks Fifth Avenue property are but one example, and relatively speaking, not a very big one. The landscape is full of them. Sometimes you find vacant properties even in the heart of New York City, held for increase, or the Depression season variant of these newly erected ghost buildings asking rents which people now just can't afford and which landlords refuse to lower. New York City, where people are so desperate for even minuscule apartments, those professionals who can afford them, that is, forget being a cobbler and living in the city these days, that they scan the obituaries for rental opportunities. Look around Main Street here in suburban USA, and you will find more ghost vacancies, stores and offices we can no longer afford to rent, and the landlords aren't dropping the rent. Look at great parts of the landscape across the country. Try this experiment the next time you are flying. Look down at the outskirts of even the most densely populated areas. Scan the ground from the air. You will notice how quickly congestion, apparent overpopulation, gives way to great unpopulated stretches, and only the smallest fraction of that is public parkland. I saw this over Puerto Rico this summer. San Juan, a city of more than 1 million people, many of them packed together in the barrios that are famous for crime and poverty. But the island of Puerto Rico, on the whole, seen from the air, verdant, luxurious, like one great nature preserve. Can the people of Puerto Rico use that land even if, as is apparent from the air, no one is doing so? They cannot. It is privately owned. On the subject of private property and land, by the way, the provenance of private land ownership is itself a kind of interesting one. As George points out, if you go back in history in any region far enough, you find that land was held in common for public access. Consider the concept of the commons, or the view of land tenure held by many Native American tribes. Or even in feudal times, land was held by the landholder to some extent in trust for the public. Feudal tenure carried with it public obligation, including, but not limited to, the obligation to provide for the public defense by fielding a fighting force. There are still vestiges in law, albeit meaningless ones now, of the difference between real property, that is land, and personal property, In the archaic practices of the conveyance of land, which once were meaningful and connected with the public nature of land tenure. The point being, land was not always the subject of private ownership as it is today. Moreover, chains of title, if you trace them back far enough, originate either in conquest or theft or both. There came a time in England centuries ago when the public obligations of even the feudal lord gave way to private land holdings. The commons were long ago fenced in and reduced to private ownership, most of them. At some point, or so I remember reading, great estates were carved out of the landscape and doled out as private gifts by the English monarch to his favorites. In this country, we can look back to genocide that dispossessed the aboriginal inhabitants in order to start many chains of title, and particularly out west to claim jumping and other ruthless practices of land grabbing. As to Malthusianism, I put it to you that we are too ready to blame the sheer presence and increase in number of people on the planet for the existence of poverty. Rather, I think the true usefulness of the theory is a pernicious one. From the point of view of great landed interests, it's a wonderful diversion from the true source of economic problems. It puts the blame on nature, and what better way to keep it off of the entirely man-made institution of private property and land? Well, all of that brings me finally to the second puzzle I was going to talk about today. If George's thinking is so compelling and the wrong he analyzed so glaring, why has that wrong not met with greater opposition, and why is George by this day relegated to virtual obscurity? George's influence has, in its time, been greater abroad than in this, his native country. It has extended to Australia, New Zealand, Denmark, Ireland for a time, England, Vancouver. It is true that there are still societies, to judge by internet listings, promulgating George's ideas and reform proposals. And even here, there are still the last vestiges of so-called single tax communities inspired by George's thinking. Fairhope, Alabama, Arden, Delaware, Free Acres, a small pocket of land about a 15-minute drive from here at Berkeley Heights. The residents of those communities may have heard the name of Henry George, but nearly all of them are wholly unfamiliar with his works. Vestiges, too, perhaps, have been left in the form of property taxes, even in this state, but those fall on improvements as well as land, and in any event vie for our funds with plenty of other taxes that, to a Georgist way of thinking, are wrong-headed and harmful. Given the very real and considerable excitement George stirred up in his day, here and elsewhere, how have the ideas he debated receded into obscurity? There have been several suggestions. One explanation I have read has to do with the shift in the academic approach to the study of economic problems. That study used to be known by the term political economy. Thinkers in the field, such as Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, David Ricardo, the French physiocrats that I've mentioned before, attempted, as George did after them, to discover economic laws by analyzing the workings of society using logic, common sense, and thought experiment. But political economy began during George's lifetime to be replaced in the colleges with the study of economics as we know it today. This has included the so-called Austrian school and monetarist theory, and now has a fair emphasis on statistics and mathematical modeling. To the Georgist way of thinking, a science has been replaced with a kind of metaphysical casuistry, as if in the place of natural philosophy you now have the study of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. As a Georgist might put it, the economist can tell you with charts and graphs how many poor people there might be in a given area, but of insight into why wages fall and unemployment rises, why there is poverty, there is none. But what explains the disappearance of a once vibrant and fascinating study with a jargon-filled, hyper-technical, and essentially entirely different one? It has been suggested that the change has to do with the influence of wealthy interests in academe. As an example, it is certainly true that the Rockefellers have had a huge endowing interest in Columbia University. I know that they did own the land under it, and for all I know, they still do. That's just one example. There are others that are similar. Similarly, it is possible to see in the influence of great wealth over large media in this age of ever more concentrated corporate ownership another factor in the relative obscurity into which George's thinking has fallen. However, as much as I find these conspiracy theories attractive, and you know I find them attractive, I must admit that I don't think they are the whole story. I think there are ideological trends that have also contributed to the virtual disappearance of George's thoughts from the popular mental landscape. The advent and relative vitality of social Darwinism, the view that, and this should apply not only to the animal kingdom, but to the human one, human sphere as well, the view that the important law, and probably the only important law that applies to the workings of society, is survival of the fittest, the law of the jungle, dog eat dog. This is a perennial opponent of any proposal for reform that is based on considerations of justice and fairness. The strain of relativism or subjectivism, that's almost as hard to say as aqua circuitism. But in any event, relativism or subjectivism in modern intellectual thought, that is the view that there is no such thing as truth, that there are no absolute principles worth adhering to, is another natural opponent to thinking like George's, particularly as we are talking about the field of social problems, and especially fertile ground for relativism. But beyond that, I think there also lies the difficulty of getting people to think for themselves. Think for themselves, that's a bit of a redundancy. I mean, who else are you going to think for? The difficulty of getting people to think. Even the type of thinking that George valued most, which is to say thinking that eschews jargon and does not depend upon technical training, does take some time and some energy. And as we are pressed to run harder and harder just to stay in the same place, most days time, even for fairly simple thought, is harder to come by. My life is as much an example of that as anybody's. Introduced to these ideas in my youth, I consider how long it has taken me to take them up again and spend some thought on them. So it is that nowadays George is, in this country at least, all but forgotten. When I was 18, many moons ago, I went to England with a friend of mine and met a 90-year-old ex-Labour Party member of the House of Commons, Sir Andrew McLaren, who could speak of the Georgist movement, wrongly I think, as if it were still the hot going thing. He has passed on, needless to say, and now, even at the annual convention of what is left in the way of Georgists, you are as likely as not to have the time passed by those in attendance there playing a board game for the nostalgic value that's in it. Monopoly is the game I'm talking about, it having been, and this is no joke, originated many years ago by followers of Henry George. People sitting around playing Monopoly. That is, in this country at least, what the once vibrant Commonwealth land movement, also called the single tax movement, has come to. But dormant as they may seem, the ideas, like certain tenacious seeds, have a way of living on. This talk is only an introduction, and the ideas I've mentioned, many of them anyway, do require and I think deserve more attention if you want to be in a position to evaluate them properly. I am, of course, ready to teach a 10-session course on this stuff if there are enough people, either now or in the future, interested. There's a contact sheet if you want to give me contact info. Don't feel obligated. But in any event, remember those two guys, those two dumb guys in the forest lugging that deer by the antlers? If, when it comes to our understanding of social problems, we have been moving in the wrong direction, and we have, I believe that the thinking I speak of today is what's needed to get us moving back to the car. In any event, I commend George's writings to your attention. If there are questions, I don't know if they have questions. If anybody, do you want to call for them? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Session class.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I find this very, very interesting. Thank you for presenting this today. Because I was just speaking yesterday with someone about why young people are not so politically active. And I said, you know, you can thank Ronald Reagan for that. Because Ronald Reagan started the end of affordable housing. Now, you're talking about land, but it also has to do with how much people have to pay for rent and to access a home. Mm-hmm. And it's through the roof now with speculation and other things, but also due to short supply. I mean, a lot of the affordable housing programs that were in place and going in the 60s, 70s, and 80s were cut loose, done. And also access to public housing. A lot of the money to repair public housing was returned in Newark. So when they say, oh, they're in such terrible shape, well, they made a point not to repair them because they want the land under it. And they own the land under it. And now we can look and see farmland in Newark. Right? You talk about Saks. Well, look at poor Newark.
Yeah.
You know, you can drive down Springfield or South Orange Avenue and look at the vast acreage, which should be probably turned over to a central park for Newark. You know, because why build more housing when people in Newark can't afford it? There's vacant housing standing in Newark.
Right.
Just like you described New York. They don't want to make it available to people. So this is a conundrum, and I think a lot has to do with supply and demand, particularly for housing. And yes, it's directly related to poverty.
A comment comes to mind, which is to support what you're saying. In New York, which I guess I'm more familiar with as an ex-New Yorker, but you know this probably exists elsewhere as well. The interaction between legislation or policy making and land policy is, you know, it's an interesting one. Where rent control exists in New York, you know, rent control being a good thing for those of us who don't own land in New York and have rented in New York, the population in general, it seems to me, if I take the long view and look at it over the years, if you consider what rents are like in New York as opposed to 10 or 20 years ago, even though you have at times had laws in New York and policies that cap the amount that rent can be increased, there's this inexorable pressure against them. Whatever the laws are, whoever makes them, however they operate, somehow land ownership in New York City has, with very lucky little teeny pockets, gotten just constant increase in rent. So, and I think it's the pressure of the power of those interests against the whatever legislative force has been brought to bear against it. It's exactly what you're saying. It's just another related comment.
Except not lucky where those pockets exist. They're usually Mitchell-Ama housing.
Exactly. I mean, people who are, you know, but you think of them, if you have friends, you know, you think of them as tremendously lucky because they're, you know, they're able, they're sort of rocks against the tide, and they have these great rent deals. But just about everybody has not been able to resist it. Yes.
There's something that wasn't clear to me about George or your interpretation or whatever, and that's the relationship between land as a place to produce food and land as a place for housing. What's the
okay? All right.
Talking about housing.
Yeah. Let me make a comment. And I mean, some of the lack of clarity, you know, in here, it certainly could be mine, but at least my hope, maybe a delusion, some will be because it's hard, even as long as I talk, to get all the details out, to make things clear. But in George's thinking, land includes land used for agricultural purposes, but also residential land, land used for industrial purposes, land used for commercial purposes, so it would be land used for office space, land used for retail, land used for residence. You know, the central idea being that the only way that human civilization can produce the wealth, which is what we need to survive off of, food, clothing, and shelter, that kind of thing, is through access to land. But you know, in the details of various writings that George did, you see that, you know, it's not simply agriculture, which some of the earlier thinkers on this subject sort of reduced the discussion to. It's also, you know, commercial space, warehouse space. Part of production is not just, production includes the bringing of finished goods to market, the transporting of them, bringing them essentially to the consumer. For service businesses, increasingly because of things like this, one may need less and less physical space on the planet in order to operate. But, you know, and I, as a rent payer, as an office rent payer, I ask myself, what is the least I can get away with and still practice law? It seems to me just a desk and, and room for this is almost enough. But you still, you know, if you unless you have an internet business, you need some land to meet people. And even if you do have an internet business, you have to have a place to sit with your desk. You probably could use a bathroom, you know, so and maybe a gracious place to live. So even residential property is, you know, you need it to survive. You need a place to live. So all of that is included in George's conception of land. Yes?
Is there any, do you think that there's been any shift in its relevance and relevance of these theories with the internet, the fact that there are now kind of businesses that have no physical location? You no longer need...
Yeah, that ties into what I was just saying. Well, yeah, it's an interesting question, one that I've asked myself about, and I'll just see if I can come up with a quick comment off the top of my head. I mean, it actually continues the comment I just had. If we were able to produce, this is my answer, if we were able to produce wealth without needing access to land, land as kind of the physical universe, mostly the dry universe because we are land animals, even if you live at sea, eventually your boat is built on land, you need to come back to land, that's where your land comes from. We haven't yet perfected a spaceship kind of thing. And even if we did, there would be material, you know, the material universe has to be worked up into the things that create wealth. We can't do that ourselves. Even if you minimize the need to have contact with land, and IT has done that, information technology, in many businesses, not all, obviously agriculture, a computer doesn't grow you a tomato. But in the service business, in retail, you know, we had what they call boxes, you had actual stores. A lot of that is now, you know, trade is now being conducted on the internet. And that's kind of reduced the footprint in a lot of businesses for the need for the access to land. But it hasn't and it cannot eliminate it. I mean, you need land to make this. You know, the stuff it's made out of, you need a place for people to sit while they're designing it. You can't eliminate the need for human beings to have land. But it is fascinating. It does create a shift in different industries. But the problem, while it has modified, and I would put it to you, it's been modified most dramatically lately, but, you know, since 100 or 200 years ago, the advent of electricity, a lot of things are less land intensive than they used to be. But the dynamics are the same. That would be my answer.
And there are people trying to control ownership of those.
Yes, and sometimes people feel that ownership and access to the internet or to the airwaves should be considered, should be grouped together with land. I disagree because I think the distinction between land, the physical universe from which material wealth is drawn, including computers, is such a vital distinction between that and activities and other, you know, labor and capital, that it's seminal to the value of George's thought. And even though it kind of was explored by people who preceded him, it really isn't an idea that many other people have developed. So I wouldn't want to lose it. Yes?
Do you see the recent court rulings against the eminent domain situation down the shore and also the access to public beaches? Is this relevant to this discussion?
I think so, but I have to admit I'm not familiar with the story other than what I gleaned from it when you were asking your question. If you want to educate me a little more, go ahead, but I can comment even
down
if you don't.
In the Long Branch area, there were some small homes, and the town condemned them so they could turn them over to the developers for commercial, you know, and they said they were blight. And anyway, it was years and years that the homeowners got together, I mean, they might have been like 20 some odd homeowners, to fight this, and they won. There seems to be, you know, if you look at the trends over the past 10 years in home construction, everything is luxury. I mean, you just can't buy a home that's sufficient because they don't build them. And if you had a nice little small brick home, at least in my area, I live in Edison, I mean, they would knock it down to build these large homes with two-story hallways that when you think of the energy to heat and cool these things. So anyway, you know, the issue here was that the town wasn't condemning the property for really social goods, like to put a train station in or to, you know, it was, okay, now we'll sell it at a nice...
Well, okay, so I have my comment, which is two comments, really. One is a very general comment that almost doesn't specifically respond, but the other does. The general comment or thought I've had recently is that when you're thinking about residential real estate, residential use of land, it seems to me that a lot of the policies having to do with residential use of land are not the core target policies at which George aimed his reformism. Because, for the most part, residential property is held and used, with obviously exceptions, for, you know, fairly extensively by the people who are at least nominally the owners of that land. I mean, the situation is very different if you're talking about, you know, I forget what state it is that Robert Redford, who I otherwise like, I think he owns. Utah, is it? Utah, okay. What one guy is going to do with Utah, I don't know. I mean, that doesn't seem like a good arrangement. But when you're talking about residential property, I don't think that's so much the problem George addresses. However, the other comment I have is, which is not so much a George comment, it's just a comment. I think one sees these fights perennially, you know, not just now, but, you know, going back a number of years between, you know, certain residents in certain areas that want one use of land. And often, one is very tempted, I guess I'm a cynic, to think of you know, undue influence, of a sort of corruption. If you have large developing interests, they do seem to have the leverage that wealth gives people. If you're developer being, you know, kind of a new modern term for landholder, if you own and hold and develop a lot of land, you tend to have a lot of wealth at your disposal, and you're able to influence politics. I mean, that's my knee-jerk reaction.
Isn't there an issue of people who provide the labor being able to live in areas, you know, kind of close to where they work, and the effect on society when, you know...
Well, yeah, that's certainly a core issue, and to the extent that this particular fight down the shore, it, you know, plays into that, then I think it is a related thing. He was first.
Since part of the title of this talk is poverty, as I understand it, something like 15% of the students in the high school in South Orange Maplewood are entitled to free lunch. You get entitled to free lunch because you don't own any land and because you're poor. My question is, do you have any advice as to how one can go about working with these poor or reducing their poverty and so on an individual basis?
Not so much. I mean, I could come up with ideas of, you know, if I met a particular individual trying to, you know, get them the wherewithal to get work, I mean, that would be my approach on an individual level. But, you know, bear in mind that the thinking I've been preoccupied with lately in preparing for this talk is more global, and so my reaction is naturally going to be more global, which is or broader, which is if you want to address poverty on a society-wide level, you know, which will affect individuals, of course, if you think, if your thinking is really insightful. I believe, as George, you know, propounded, that the solution has to address the great wrong that is being done to society by the arrangement whereby private individuals, particularly on a large scale or highly valuable scale, can monopolize that aspect of the production of wealth, which is by right a public asset and not a private asset. So, I mean, I go back, I'm afraid, to the general theory in answering your question. But to get to specifics, that's something, I mean, I can touch on it. It's not going to be physically possible to go into more detail on the dynamics in one session. If it was, I would really have wanted to do it. But it's there's just too many ideas. I think they're... George's claim, and I think it's a good one, is he invites people to go through his thinking, and he lays it out, because he's a good writer, pretty clearly. And then if you buy it, you buy it. If you don't buy it, then fine. The problem is, though, it can't be done quickly. So I can't get into too many specifics, because I can't talk that fast, and if I could, you couldn't hear that fast. And you need to chew it over and talk the way we're doing, but you can't do it in one session.
You want to come back for a second reading?
Well, if you twist my arm, I suppose, you can tell I like to do this.
We unfortunately running out of time at this point.
I think there was one more. Let me get the one who's had his hand up. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yes. I think it demonstrates that the basic political issue is the fair division of labor. And I think the problem in the United States is we haven't had a labor party for so long, it's almost embarrassing. Mm-hmm. Like coming from the West Coast and in Washington, which is a labor state,
mm-hmm.
I'm embarrassed to be a Democrat in New Jersey. And the thing is people...
That could be a state motto. A great place to be embarrassed to be a Democrat.
Yeah. And the thing is, and I find people who think Clinton was a labor president or Obama is a labor president be laughable. I think until we reaffirm the issues of labor, of course being Scandinavian, I even think what's happening up there is true. But until we reaffirm the issues of labor in terms of the fair distribution of the wealth that is created by labor, we're going to continue to be in trouble.
Well, again, I think your comment invites like a whole other session. There is a huge amount of overlap between what you're saying. I mean, and George's thinking and the spirit of what he says. He did address the Knights of Labor at some point many years ago when he was alive. And the labor movement has an interesting, another side lecture, an interesting history of overlap with the labor movement, between George and the labor movement. In the sense that the Labour Party in England in some ways was inspired by the activities and speaking which was very active in the UK by George. Some of the early Labour Party members, including this ancient now deceased Sir Andrew McLaren, really, you know, got excited by a lot of what he was talking about. There's a lot of overlap, but there are sort of interesting distinctions, differences between the labor movement as it exists or fails to exist today and as it existed in the form that George was involved with it in. Fit subject for more talk, but I agree. And I think the interesting thing is there's a lot of common ground between not just labor, but let's say this socialist thinking, and for lack of a better word, George's thinking. Where they are completely in agreement is that, and a lot of other people, including people who maybe not thought about this very much, it seems that the problems of poverty and low wages and unemployment that exist today, clearly to all of these groups and schools of thought, is not a problem in the capacity of producing wealth, because we have that more than ever. It must be not in the ability to produce it, but in how it's being distributed. There's a lot of common ground.
There.
But But there are thoughts that have been lost, almost lost, virtually almost lost to history, to analyze what those problems are, that I think are highly valuable, and I'd love to see them continue to be alive.